Welcome to the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast, featuring some of the University of Wisconsin's best and brightest faculty and staff. This installment features Richard Davidson, a Vilas Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry, and Director of both the W.M. Keck Laboratory for Functional Brain Imaging and Behavior and the Laboratory of Affective Neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Good afternoon. What a great crowd. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Richard Davidson, whose presentation, as you can tell by the screen, is Changing Your Mind, Changing Your Brain. Dr. Davidson is internationally renowned in his research on the neural substrates of emotion and emotional disorders. After receiving a PhD in psychology from Harvard University, Dr. Davidson joined the University of Wisconsin faculty in 1984. He is the William James and Vilas Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry, and he directs two University of Wisconsin-Madison laboratories, the Weizmann Center Brain Imaging Laboratory and the Laboratory for Affective Neuroscience. And both of these have produced some of the most important new knowledge about the role of emotion in the human experience. The laboratory program he has developed at the Weizmann Center includes most advanced brain imaging technologies available and a diverse team of world-class scientists. He and his expanding group of colleagues have brought science to the cusp of understanding how emotions function in the brain, why some people suffer from depression and other social disorders, and how we may be able to harness our emotions to improve our mental and physical well-being. Dr. Davidson's record of accomplishments is remarkable. He has published more than 200 articles, many chapters and reviews, and edited 13 books. He is founding co-editor of the scientific journal Emotion, and serves on the editorial boards of numerous major scientific journals. Dr. Davidson is a recipient of many awards for his research, including the American Psychological Association's most prestigious award for lifetime achievement, the Award for Distinguished Scientific Contributions. Dr. Davidson's research appears in the media so often that Craig Limlinger, a reporter for the Capital Times, said, "Dr. Davidson is everywhere." Articles about Dr. Davidson and his discoveries have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, Time Magazine, the Wisconsin State Journal, and countless other publications and magazines. Last March, Dr. Davidson's research was a focal point of a PBS special called The New Medicine, a two-hour documentary hosted by the late Dana Reeve. This past May, Time Magazine named Dr. Davidson one of the world's 100 most influential people and featured an article about his research in their May 8th special edition. You know, we're going through putting some remarks together. There just were tons of different things to say, but let me just share two things from two different sources that I think will set the stage for what you're about to hear. First one comes from the Wisconsin Academy Review, and it's quoted, "Neuroscientist Richard Davidson is proving that we can harness our emotions to improve our mental and physical well-being. Davidson's studies have been groundbreaking in charting the emotional geography of the brain." And then perhaps one of the highest compliments you can be paid, and that is by a fellow colleague. And this individual is Kenneth Robbins, and he simply says, he, referring to Richie, is a superstar. That was, he asks us not to use that term around the office, but he is really a superstar. He is one of the foremost researchers at this time. I mean, that's really quite something. I'm so pleased that you have joined us today to learn about Dr. Davidson's interesting research, and I encourage you to contact the Weizmann Center at any time If you have any additional interests, if you'd like to become more involved, if you'd just like to come out and visit or have more information. It's also wonderful to have several members of what we call the Wiseman Center's Board of Visitors and that are present today. And I'd ask that they would stand briefly. Jane Coleman and Hal Meyer are with us. Jane and Hal are members of our Board of Visitors. And Joe Sensenbrenner, Joe, is a member of our Brain Imaging Committee. The Wiseman Center's Board of Visitors, along with its members of its various subcommittees, is truly an extraordinary group of people who have offered excellent feedback and advice on Wiseman Center development priorities and fundraising strategies. Thank you again for coming today and for all of your support and participation. Now, please join me as I welcome Dr. Richard Davidson.
Thank you all very, very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to especially thank the UW Foundation for their important role in making much of this possible, and especially Dave Sugar, who's just been a joy to work with since he has been with us. He reminded me at lunch that he's only been with us in this official capacity at the Wiseman Center for 1 year, but his influence has been so significant and enduring that it really feels like he's been with us much longer. What I'd like to do today in the short time that we have is share with you some of the excitement of modern neuroscience research, particularly as it pertains to important domains of human experience and to some significant problems in our society. And I'm going to leave you with a hopeful message, and that message is contained in a couple of slides. But I want to first share with you the fact that this general area has been an important one in the popular culture. This was the cover of a National Geographic last year that actually has a picture of a monk whose brain activity is being recorded. This was taken in our laboratory. And the central focus of my remarks today revolve around a topic that we call neuroplasticity. This is the program, actually, of a very small tutorial that the Dalai Lama asked me to arrange for him that was held at his house in Dharamsala, India, to showcase the most important modern research on this topic of neuroplasticity. And what neuroplasticity refers to is the fact that the brain is the organ which is built to change in response to experience, to change in response to training, more than any other organ of your body. And that fact confers some very interesting properties which will be the subject of my remarks today. I want to just share with you what it's like to be at one of these meetings with the Dalai Lama. I'll talk more about that. This is when we were first beginning the meeting. Sitting in the hot seat next to the Dalai Lama when you're presenting is unlike any other scientific discourse. First of all, he interrupts you constantly. It's like having a superstar graduate student who wants to make sure that every single word is absolutely clear and fully understood and digested. And he will not let a word go by without total clarity. And it's extremely demanding a wonderful opportunity. This is just what the room looks like there. So here are the big points that I'm going to emphasize in my remarks today. The first is that we can change our brains by changing our minds. You all can do that, and it is within all of our capacity to do that, and I'll say more about that as we go along. Changing our minds, however, requires systematic training. It's not something that we can do lightheartedly, and it is not something that we can do casually. If you want to learn how to play golf and do it well, you all know that you're not just going to be able to pick up a club and be a expert golfer without a lot of training. Similarly, cultivating certain skills of mind requires comparable training. We know as a culture today, most middle-class Americans know that if we are to maintain our physical health, it's very important that we exercise on a regular basis. And many of us have incorporated exercise in our daily routine. Similarly, training the mind requires exercise. And if one is going to enjoy the benefits from training one's mind, it is something that needs to be done on a regular basis, continuously. And we'll come back to this, and I'll amplify on it a little later. Now, what this implies for us is that we can alter traits like happiness, and we can also develop what I've been calling neurally inspired behavioral treatments for complex disorders like autism. And I'm going to give you an example of that as we go along. So by understanding how complex traits like happiness or complex disorders like autism are actually instantiated in the brain, we can design interventions that are behavioral interventions whereby changing our mind, we can change our brains in ways that are beneficial. So I'm going to first start with the example of happiness, and then I'm going to give you another example from our current research on autism. So first on happiness, this cover of Time magazine just underscores how important happiness is in our culture today. This is a recent issue of Time. Some of the work that we're doing in our lab was featured in this issue. All human beings are very interested in promoting their own happiness. One of the big problems, though, is that people tend to be pretty poor at predicting what will make them happy. That sounds a little bit incongruous, but I'll show you that it is true. So before we do that, I want to just remind you that happiness has a very special status in our country, because in addition to being a state or a trait or a skill, as I'll suggest, in our country, it's an unalienable right. So you all know these words that were penned by Thomas Jefferson quite some time ago, and I don't need to remind you that this is something that was a central principle in the founding of our country. Unfortunately, I don't think that it has been taken sufficiently seriously in modern times. And it is my hope and conviction that some of the scientific work being done in this area will help bring this to the fore. Now, I also want to say at the outset that happiness is not just some ephemeral feeling, but it also can be a matter of life and death. These are actual data from a Finnish epidemiological study that was done on about 30,000 individuals that were followed over a 20-year period. And these individuals were asked simply the question about how happy they were. And without going into a lot of detail, what these data show is that people who report themselves to be very unhappy show more than a tenfold increase in the incidence of suicide attempts over the course of a two-decade period. So quality of happiness that an individual enjoys in his or her life turns out to be a very significant fact for mental health. So what is happiness? I'm going to sort of dodge this bullet by giving you a definition that was offered by a prominent psychologist, Martin Seligman, who works at the University of Pennsylvania. And he defined happiness as being comprised of three major components. The first component he calls pleasure or positive emotion. It can be about the past, the present, or the future. And most individuals operate within a fairly narrow range. The second property is what is called engagement. And this refers to goal-directed activity, being absorbed in a particular activity. The third component Seligman labels as meaning. Belonging to or serving something larger than oneself. Now, I want to ask the question about how malleable happiness is, and this relates to the issue that I alluded to earlier about people being pretty poor at predicting what will make them happy. So I'm going to ask three questions now. And show you data relevant to each of these three questions. Now, these data that I'm about to show you are real data. I didn't make them up. They come from very large sample sizes. They're survey measures, and I'll turn to the brain right after this, but this is a very important context in which to view some of the brain research. So the first question that I'll ask is whether marriage can buy you happiness. And here's the answer. And so what these data show is this. At point zero is the point at which you get married. And this is a measure of happiness. Now, these are real data. So you can see that at the point that a person gets married, he or she reports much higher levels of happiness. But look what happens 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. At 5 years after marriage, people are actually reporting lower levels of happiness than when they started. Now, I've been happily married for 30 years, so there are definitely exceptions to this. But these are average data. This is what the data actually show. Now we can ask what the flip side is. Does widowhood produce unhappiness? And here's the answer. So you do take a big hit, a big drop in happiness here, but it's really quite astounding to see how resilient most people are in showing a very rapid rebound back to levels that are pretty comparable to what they were when they began. Now, the third question in this series is the question that our culture is particularly obsessed with, and that's the question about whether money can buy you happiness. And what I do on this next slide is I show you the gross domestic product of the United States over a 50-year period, and on top of that, plot an index that we can think of as a gross national happiness indicator. It doesn't matter what index you use, they all show basically the same thing. And this is what it shows. The light line here is the gross domestic product of the United States, and this is a graph that goes from 1946 to 1996. And you can see a very rapid rise in that reflects the economic success of our country. And in the darker line is plotted the percentage of people who report themselves to be very happy across this time period. Doesn't matter, as I said, what index you use. And you can see that there is just no relation in these findings between the percentage of people reporting themselves to be very happy and the economic success of our country. So if anything, you see a slight decline over time. So where does all this leave us? Well, one question which we are left with is whether happiness can actually be enhanced. If these significant social conditions don't seem to have much effect on it. Can it be enhanced? Are we all stuck at our respective set points? And that's the question that I'll turn to in the next few minutes. But I first want to now give a little précis of how we can actually study happiness and other emotions using more objective scientific methods and take you on a little tour of how we do this kind of work in our laboratory. And so what I'd first like to do is just to show you an excerpt from a video clip. There won't be any sound. I'll be talking over it. And this just is to illustrate how we can do some of these experiments in the laboratory. What you'll see in this clip is a woman who is wearing a funny cap. This is used to measure brain electrical signals. And at the time that this videotape is made, the woman does not know she's being videotaped. She's informed afterwards, and her permission is requested to use the tape. She is being exposed to a short film clip that depicts a mother who is dying of cardiomyopathy, and the mother is saying goodbye to her 10-year-old daughter. You can see that this provokes quite strong emotion in the viewer. You don't need to be trained in any kind of special analysis of facial expression to see this. You can see that she's actually crying. Many of the participants in this study actually cry in response to this film clip. You also see how complex her reaction is because she's using various strategies to control her emotions as well. Now, the nice thing about these kinds of procedures is you can show them other kinds of film clips. We are now seeing the same person, obviously, who's now being shown a medley of film clips that were put together from Steve Martin movies. You can see that a very different constellation of expressive behavior is evoked. Using this kind of strategy, we can isolate brain signals that are associated with different emotions to come to some better understanding of what the brain is doing during these different emotional states. So we've done a whole series of studies, which I won't bore you with, but we can use these and other brain scanning methods to peer into the brain with unprecedented precision, for the first time in human history, to see what is going on in the brain non-invasively when we activate different emotions in our participants. This is just a picture of a signature, if you will, that you get during the activation of certain positive emotions with happiness as the predominant emotion. And during the activation of negative emotions, you get a very different constellation of brain activity. Now, I want to move to the example of autism, and then I'm going to come back to happiness because there's actually more research on interventions there. We are at the laboratory at the Weissman Center, in addition to our work on enhancing happiness in individuals like yourselves, ordinary people who are normal, if you will, and want to just live more optimally. We also work with individuals with specific kinds of disabilities, and one of the disabilities that we have been focusing a lot on over the last 5 years is autism. And autism is a fascinating disorder because it involves abnormalities in social and emotional functioning, and much of our previous work on the emotional brain really can be brought to bear on helping to understand what's going on in autism. I want to read you this quote. This is from an adult autistic who I think had a very deep insight into the nature of autism, at least a specific type of autism. So this individual said, "I am also mute. Like many autistics, I spoke as a child, then stopped when I could no longer stand the unbelievable anxiety and sensation of self-disintegration that came with the effort of talking. Autistic muteness is not due to mechanical inability to produce words and sounds. It is rather an emotional and cognitive issue. This was written by an adult autistic who is mute. Now, one of the things that we have been studying in the laboratory is trying to get a better understanding of the nature of some of the social and emotional abnormalities in autism. And one of the most significant social stimuli in our everyday world is human faces. Human faces are very significant in all our social interactions and provide enormous information to us about our immediate social surroundings. And in order for us to function socially, we need to be able to decode the emotional signals that others are exhibiting. Without that ability, our capacity for normal social exchange is very significantly compromised. And so we have been studying how children with autism and adults with autism process human faces that are both neutral and emotional. And I want to show you some examples of this. And one of the things that we do is we present these faces to people while they're in an MRI scanner so we can measure what's going on in their brain. But we also use very sensitive laser eye tracking to know precisely where their eyes are focused when they're actually viewing a face. And I'm going to show you now a little animation where this dot that you see on this face represents where the person's eyes are actually focused on this actual stimulus. And so this is a typically developing normal person, and these facial stimuli are presented for 3 seconds when we present them in the MRI scanner, and you can see that most of the time this person is focused around the eye region of the face. In this experiment, we present both neutral faces and emotional faces, and the task of the person is to tell us what emotion is being depicted. Now, let me show you what a typical autistic looks like when he is viewing the same face. This is a very typical pattern of an individual with autism. And you can see that they are fixating this face mostly in the mouth region of the face and spending very little time around the eyes. Now, it turns out that the eyes are really what conveys the vast majority of the emotional information in a face. And if you don't scan the eyes, you're not going to pick up information from the face. And we believe that there is a reason why individuals with autism are not spending a lot of time around the eye region of the face, and that has to do with this structure in the brain that is outlined in red here. And this is an actual three-dimensional outline of a real brain from a child with autism, and this is the amygdala on each side of the brain. The amygdala is a small structure that is buried within the medial temporal lobe of the brain. The temporal lobe is on the side of the head, and the temporal lobe folds around, and on each side is this small structure called the amygdala, which plays a very important role in our social and emotional behavior. And for a variety of reasons, we and other scientists believe that abnormalities in the amygdala may play a key role in certain core symptoms of autism. Now, in our brain scanning, this is a very complicated slide, and I'm just going to use it to make one important point. But in our brain scanning studies, what we find is that when children with autism avoid fixating in the eye region of the face, they actually show reduced activation in the amygdala. So avoiding looking at the eyes actually is serving a purpose we believe, and the purpose is to reduce uncomfortable levels of emotional arousal that the children are experiencing when they view the face. And if you think back to the quote that I showed you when I started this section on autism about the unbelievable anxiety that this autistic was reporting in social interaction, one way to help reduce these levels of unbelievable anxiety is to avoid fixating on the eye region of the face. And so one of the challenges becomes teaching children with autism how to pick up information from the face and at the same time reducing their emotional arousal to keep it in check so that they don't experience these very high levels of anxiety. And this is where neurally inspired behavioral treatments, we think, can play a very important role, and our laboratory is pioneering in the development of training procedures now which are based upon this new understanding of the autistic brain. So this is actually a quote which comes from one of the individuals who participated in our research, and we just asked him to talk about his experience as an adult with autism. This is actually someone who is a student here at UW, who is a high-functioning autistic, but one who clearly has significant autism. And he says, "It's painful for me to look at people's faces. I don't even like to look at myself in the mirror." Very poignant. And he is someone who showed very significant gaze aversion in our study, but his gaze aversion served the purpose of reducing the activation in his amygdala. So I want to now turn to evidence on neuroplasticity which underscores how the brain can change in response to experience and in response to training. And there are just a few examples that I've listed here. One is musical training. There is good research which indicates that over the course of musical training in an individual, particularly who begins such training early in life, there is a dramatic reorganization of the brain. And it's not just functional. There are actually structural changes in the brain that occur as a function of the musical training. We know that acquisition of certain kinds of motor skills are associated with systematic changes in the brain, both functionally and structurally. We know from research at the animal level that how a mother behaves toward her offspring dramatically affects not just the behavior of the offspring, but remarkably can actually change the expression of genes in the brain of the offspring. And the gene expression can be changed for the entire duration of the life of the organism. So this is a way where one can, through the social environment, actually influence gene expression in the brain directly. And the mechanisms through which that occurs have been well worked out in the molecular biology literature. So this is actual molecular mechanisms through which social environmental influences may be having effects on the brain. And finally, there's a topic or a concept that we call neurogenesis, which is really an amazing idea. This is an idea that I and all of my colleagues when we were students, actually just until a few years ago, were taught simply didn't occur. What neurogenesis means is the growth of new brain cells. We were all taught that the brain is different from your skin or other organs in the body, where if it's injured, there is healing and a regeneration of the cells. We were all taught that the brain is different. The brain is built with a fixed complement of neurons, and the process of development was one of irrevocable cell death. We now know that that is simply and definitively wrong. The brain grows new cells every single day. Each of you grows somewhere around 5,000 new cells a day throughout your entire life, and it occurs throughout the entire lifespan. We also know from new research that stress impairs neurogenesis. We know that physical exercise promotes neurogenesis. Now, we don't know what effects mental exercise has, but from all of the work that is done at the animal level, there is every reason to believe that mental exercise will promote neurogenesis as well. Now, this just makes more formal something I said earlier. We're developing intervention procedures to teach individuals with autism to extract the relevant emotional information from faces, and they are taught to simultaneously keep in check, if you will, the activation levels in their amygdala. And this is an example of how we can use modern brain research to actually formulate, to develop new interventions that are directly based on our understanding of the brain and based on our ideas of neuroplasticity and the facts of neuroplasticity. We should see changes in the brain that are produced by these kinds of behavioral training procedures. And this is something that we're that's just ongoing now in our laboratory. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to turn to the impact of training the mind on brain signals that are associated with emotion and particularly associated with happiness. And in this work, I'm going to turn to the studies that we've been doing on the set of mental training procedures that we subsume under the rubric of meditation. Now, if you look at this picture, most people, when they look at this picture, kind of initially have some aversion, and if you show this picture to college students, the predominant emotional response is disgust. Well, if I told you to look at this picture, and I gave you a very, very short training, and I said, I want you to look at this picture and have the aspiration that this baby who has a tumor growing out of its eye will be treated well, treated properly, and that this baby will go on to become healthy, will go on to develop appropriate eyesight, and live a life that is fulfilling. And I want you to hold that aspiration consciously as you look at this picture. Well, and I give you, say, 15 minutes of training to do that. It turns out that even that kind of short-term training in that simple mental practice has pronounced effects on the brain. We've done that study, and these are the results of it. And again, I won't bore you with the details, but one of the important questions was whether that simple mental aspiration will have an effect on the amygdala, which I told you a little bit about, this very important brain structure that is deep within the temporal lobes of the brain. And we can probe this using these modern brain imaging techniques. And what these findings show is that when you have that mental aspiration to reduce suffering, you show a decrease in activation in the amygdala. Now, we also find that there is variation across people in the extent to which a person shows these changes, and that variation is associated with changes, with differences in what we call peripheral biology that may be relevant to health. Peripheral biology refers to the biology below the neck. And one of the other important research themes in the work that I do is, what is the connection between the signals in the brain that are associated with emotion and other bodily processes that may be important for our health? And one of the things that we did in this particular study is we measured certain aspects of the endocrine system, and we were specifically interested in the stress hormone cortisol. Cortisol is a hormone that we all produce. It's critical for life. And it is secreted by the adrenal gland from signals that originate in the brain. And there's a regular diurnal variation in cortisol. It tends to be high in the morning, and it goes down over the course of the day. And this is actually a graph that shows the typical diurnal variation. This is when you get up in the morning, your cortisol is high, and it goes down at the end of the day. Now, it's very important for health and has very important health consequences as to whether your cortisol really goes down at the end of the day or remains relatively elevated. And in fact, there's a recent paper that was published by a group at Stanford which found that among women with metastatic breast cancer, those whose cortisol didn't go down at the end of the day were much more likely to die sooner. So it actually has very dramatic health consequences in certain populations which are at risk. And it turns out that if you are very good at reducing your activation in the amygdala and are able to cultivate that mental aspiration with clarity and with conviction, your cortisol is more likely to go down at the end of the day. You have a more adaptive pattern of cortisol. And so what's going on in your head appears to have some connection to what's going on in your body in ways that may be very consequential over the long haul for your physical health. Now, there's a lot of hard-nosed data to support those claims, which I'm going to skip over. But I just want to share with you one set of findings, and that is those people whose cortisol, this is all the different people's cortisol profiles, you can see some are high, some are low at the end of the day. Those people whose profiles are higher at the end of the day, who have a flatter slope, tend to have larger waist circumference, they perform more poorly on memory tasks, they have lower perceived social support, higher perceived stress. There's a whole constellation of maladaptive characteristics that are associated with individuals who don't turn off their cortisol at the end of the day. And those and people who do turn off their cortisol at the end of the day are the people who are better regulators of their emotion. So that's what all this shows. Now, one of the ways that we've been able to explore this that is very unusual is by using people who have spent many, many years of their life training their mind. This is a very unusual project that was launched in the context of a conversation that we had with the Dalai Lama when I was with him in India. About a decade ago. And what we were interested in is whether individuals who've spent a long, long time, and the criterion that we used is at least 10,000 hours. You can do the arithmetic when you go home, and you can see that 10,000 hours is a pretty large number, and the range in our study went from about 11,000 to 62,000 hours of lifetime practice. And these are individuals who are mostly monks, although not exclusively monks, but who have spent this number of hours in formal practice training their mind in specific ways. And the recruiter for these individuals is none other than the Dalai Lama himself. And so he handpicked these individuals to participate in this research. And we fly them from Asia to Madison, Wisconsin, where they spend several days in our laboratory being measured. And this is a shot of one of the monks. Another shot, we spend a lot of time talking with them, and actually a number of them have not just been participants, but really have taken on the role more of as collaborators. The person here is Mathieu Ricard, a very unusual monk. He is French by nationality, but he's been a Tibetan Buddhist monk for many years, since 1967. He also holds a PhD in molecular biology from the Pasteur Institute, where he worked with François Jacob, the Nobel laureate. And so he comes with a very unusual background and is ideally suited to be a liaison between these worlds. And this is Mathieu wired up, ready for an experiment. And this is Mathieu just after he came out of an MRI scanner. He was in the scanner for about 3.5 hours. Most people don't look like this when they come out. And so that's just another anecdotal clue about what's going on. So in this work, we began with some very, very simple kinds of experimental designs where we had these practitioners meditating or in a neutral state to try to find out what's different about their brains when they do this. And we were specifically interested in practices that they do that are designed to cultivate compassion. And it's very similar to what I showed you with in the picture of the baby with the tumor. They do a practice that's very, very similar where they train their mind to think initially of individuals who may be suffering and then have the aspiration that that suffering be relieved. And one of the claims that is made in this tradition is that the mental rehearsal of that kind of practice will increase a person's likelihood to act in a compassionate way when he or she sees individuals who are suffering in the world. Now, that claim is just a claim. We don't have scientific support for it at this point in time, although we and others are evaluating it right now. But they engage in specific practices to do this, and this is, in Mathieu Ricard's words, what they're actually trying to do. And in this case, they were generating a state in which loving compassion permeate the whole mind with no other consideration, reasoning, or discursive thoughts. And this is something that more advanced practitioners report themselves to be able to do quite readily and spontaneously. And we don't need fancy computer instrumentation to actually see changes that are going on in the brain's electrical activity. In fact, when we first saw this, we thought that there was a malfunction in our instrumentation. We spent a lot of time convincing ourselves that these signals were real because they are so extraordinary and they've never been reported before. This is the raw brain electrical record during a resting period, and then when they begin to meditate, and you can see there is a very pronounced change in the signals that we are recording, and is a change in a very specific frequency domain in the brain electrical signals, frequency band is called the gamma band, and it has been associated with focused attention and alertness in other research, although when it is seen, it is typically seen for 200 or 300 milliseconds. That is less than half a second. In this case, we see it ongoing for minutes, which has never been seen before in the in human brain recordings. It turns out that these long-term practitioners, we had 8 practitioners here, all show this effect. Some show it much more than others. These are a group of 10 age-matched control subjects who were taught the same practice, and they practiced for 2 weeks before coming into the lab. And you can see that a couple of them actually show some significant changes, but nowhere near what the long-term practitioners show. We found that the length of training, the number of lifetime hours of practice, is strongly related to this signal in the brain, so that those individuals who practice longer actually show a more pronounced effect in their brain. It appears to suggest that this is something that is related to their training, although much more research needs to be done to establish this. Now, we've done studies with MRI to probe exactly which areas of the brain are changing. And I just want to point out two of them. One is an area in the prefrontal cortex, which I'll show you in another slide in more detail. And this is an area that we have seen in other work of ours to be associated with positive emotion. It's specifically in the left prefrontal cortex. Another area which was a big surprise to us is in this slice of the brain here. And we see an area of the brain that's highly activated that comprises motor regions of the brain. And when we talk to the practitioners about what this might mean, they immediately suggested that this kind of mental training prepares you to act as soon as suffering is encountered. It, in some sense, it's a state of heightened preparedness, so that you are poised to act as soon as any suffering is encountered. To them, it was very consistent with their understanding of what it is they're doing. We were very surprised, since the practitioners are absolutely still when we are making these recordings of their brain. Despite the fact that they're still, we see this great activation in these motor regions of the brain. And this is the change that we see in the left prefrontal cortex, and it's an area of the brain that we see activated only in these long-term practitioners, as shown here. This is an area that a lot of previous work in our laboratory, as well as in other scientists' laboratories, has been found to be associated with certain kinds of positive emotions like happiness. So let me now just summarize and conclude, and I'll have plenty of time for questions. I'm sure there'll be some. We can use mental strategies and mental training to change our brains. That's really the overriding take-home message. External factors, as I've shown you, have only limited effects on our level of happiness. Happiness and resilience can be enhanced with simple mental training, and these training procedures, we found, can change the brain in very specific ways. Resilient profiles of brain function are associated with downstream effects on the body. In the endocrine system, which I've shown you, we also have evidence that indicates that it changes your immune system, and these changes may promote positive health. In the work that we're doing on autism, it suggests that autism is a complex disorder that involves the brain's emotional circuitry. And though although autism is highly heritable, that is, it's a strong, there are strong genetic contributions, we can still take advantage of the brain's plasticity to develop neurally inspired behavioral interventions to improve the social and emotional functioning of individuals with autism. And finally, meditation has demonstrable effects on the brain, and it may represent one of the few ways in which purely mental training has been demonstrated to have robust impact on brain function. These findings lend some support to the idea that our emotional traits can be transformed through mental training. And I'd like to now just thank the many people in my laboratory. These days, I feel like I'm an orchestra conductor, and the people who are really doing the work are listed here. They're the members of the orchestra who are an amazingly talented and diverse group, and every day I take a deep bow of gratitude to the extraordinary people in my lab. And one person who has facilitated our brain imaging work a lot is our masterful MRI tech, and I believe that his parents are here in the audience, Michael Anderle, and this is Michael at the console of our MRI scanner. And I'd like to finally end with one of my favorite quotes, and this was written by Albert Einstein in 1921. A human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this installment of the Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast. For more information on this and other topics, please visit the University of Wisconsin Foundation homepage at www.uwfoundation.wisc.edu.